Good afternoon. I'm still writing this stuff. You only gave me 6 months' notice, but I'm still writing it. The title is A Little Rebellion Now and Then is a Very Good Thing. I stole the title, but I'll explain that later. It's to commemorate the 164th anniversary of Australia's Eureka Stockade Rebellion, and we're within hours of the exact time when at dawn, this cowardly act of the bureaucracy and the police occurred in Ballarat. Now, the background is that 16 years ago, our then Prime Minister John Howard was invited to Ballarat to deliver the keynote address for the significant 150th anniversary of the Eureka Stockade event. But he would not go. His advisers said to him that the flag and the whole event has been hijacked by the CFMEU union, and that they were going to hijack the whole event, and it would be very embarrassing for the Prime Minister to be there in support of such an event. So he refused to go. So they invited me. And I did go. You couldn't keep me away. Now, I'll explain, firstly, how I got to be invited and why I was proud to be part of that. And secondly, and more importantly, we can look at the significance of the Eureka Stockade event, both then and now, 164 years later, and ask ourselves, are we due for another revolt? Will it be necessary for us to have another revolt to give us the kind of Australia that will reach its true potential? The reason I was proud to have been standing in Ballarat for that occasion was that 12 years previously to that, I'd been in Ballarat launching a book that I'd written about my grandfather. The book was called So I Headed West. It covered my grandfather's journey from Ballarat, where he was one of the two first graduates of the Ballarat School of Mines. He then worked in the Ballarat mines before moving westward to Broken Hill and then subsequently to Canowra and Kalgoorlie, where he opened his mining consultancy business in 1895. And now, after 125 years, it's still operating as Man West Group in Subiaco. And I'm honoured to have a copy of that book that I wrote placed in the Eureka time capsule for opening in the year 2054, which is the 200th anniversary. I put the book together really as a way of getting to know my grandfather, because he died 13 years before I was born, so I was robbed of that privilege. But I feel as though I know him very well after having put a book together. Now, my grandfather's father, which is my great-grandfather, William Manners, had left school in Scotland at age 8. And he became a shipbuilder, and then at age 26 took a job as a ship's carpenter and jumped ship and went looking for gold at Ballarat in September 1853, which is just about a year before the Eureka event. And another reason for him jumping ship was that he fell in love with a young lady on board ship. And they eventually married, and she moved to join him in Ballarat just 9 days before the Eureka event. So on that fateful that fateful Sunday morning of the Eureka Stockade, he was home, away from the stockade. He was home with his new bride, as you would. But he later became involved in the general pandemonium and had some serious contact with the police and the troopers, which committed him to the official records of the event. His wife's family later downplayed his involvement, because unless you were involved in the goldfields of Ballarat, this was not something to be proud of, having a skirmish with the police. So they, one might say, ostracised him. But now, with hindsight and contemplation, I'm extremely proud of his involvement. and of the strange sequence of events why I was asked to give the address of the 150th anniversary as a direct descendant of one of the troublemaking prospectors of that event. Now, William Manders continued prospecting and producing gold from the Queen Victoria mine, which is now part of the Sovereign Hill mine, and later at the Smeaton Reserve mine. He lived out his life in Ballarat until his death in 1901. Now, a few days before I had to head off to Ballarat to give the speech, I started trembling with absolute terror because I'd realised that I was venturing into very dangerous territory. A Western Australian going to Victoria to give them a lecture about the Eureka stockade. What? Well, somehow I managed to bluff my way through. I got away with it. So it's given me a little bit of a background so we can look at the Eureka Rebellion now and are there any lessons for us. Let me say firstly, this was a noble revolution. It was against injustice, and not to be confused with some of the current crop of revolutions which seem to be devoted to vandalism and destruction. This was very noble, and I might ask, are many of us in the room today familiar with the details of the Eureka Stockade? Is anyone? One person? Three. Is it something that's still being taught in the schools? Is Australian history still being taught in the schools? The inquiries I've made recently is that it's been removed from the syllabus. So I wonder if that's to continue to produce generations of intellectual zombies rather than develop some rugged individualists who we still think of ourselves. I don't know. Questions for another day, perhaps. If any of you would like a refresher on this event, there's a couple of old movies floating around that you could have a look at. One was the 1949 version starring Chips Rafferty, or the more recent 1984 version starring Brian Brown. Really worth watching because they will give you an insight into the sickening brutality of the police of that event. It might even tempt you to accept the challenge of honouring the memories of these gallant prospectors and even keeping their dream alive. The diggers were confronted with an insurmountable problem and they had to choose between doing something about it or doing nothing. Now, for us to judge this event, we'll have to train our eyes to see the world as it was back in 1954. The licence fee was actually collected by a bunch of armed thugs who were not paid a wage at all. They were paid out of the licence fees that they collected. And the process of doing that was to go around the top of every shaft, calling down the shaft, "Produce your licence." The prospectors had to then climb up the ladder laboriously, produce their licence, go down the ladder, and then about an hour later, another armed thug would come along called "Produce your licence." The prospectors would have to walk up the ladder again. They weren't getting any work done. I mean, how long can you put up with this nonsense? The fee, the monthly licence fee being extracted, was equivalent to a week's wages, which is equivalent to a 25% tax. It was about a 25% tax for which nothing was offered in return. They say that a fine is a tax for doing wrong and that a tax is a fine for doing well, but this tax or fine was being forcibly extracted and applied whether you found gold or not. It's been said that taxation is the price we pay for civilization, but isn't exactly the opposite the case. Taxation is the price we pay for failing to build a civilized society, so that the higher the tax level, the greater the failure. The centrally planned socialist state represents a complete defeat of the civilized world, while the totally voluntary society represents its ultimate success. So there we were in Ballarat, 1954. We had an intolerable situation being badly administered. Difficult for anyone with an Australian sense of a fair go not to side with the diggers, once you hear the facts. On my poster here are two quotes. Top left-hand corner is the quote from Peter Layla, who is the in charge of the prospectors. Actually, the two quotes remind me of a very current debate going on in the Australian newspaper, where Robert Gottliebson is pointing out there's a war raging between the Australian Taxation Office and the productive sector, and there's no common ground in the middle. Well, there is no common ground in the middle between the prospectors and the bureaucracy. There, Peter Layla's quote that I've taken is the oath that the prospectors swore. It says, "We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other and fight to defend our rights and liberties." Wonderful stuff. On the other hand, the other corner is the quote from Robert Reed, the chief bureaucrat. Now, Reed, fortunately, is a different spelling to our David Reed, so you're safe there. But his quote was like this: "If law and order are to exist on the goldfields, I still believe that nothing but crushing the agitation movement can do it." Absolutely disgusting, isn't it? So that's there was no common ground between those two sides, so it wasn't going to end well. Now, there are other issues involved beside just simply the licence fee. There were the right to vote, the ability to purchase land, the democratic reforms, and the blatant corruption of the administration. Now, all these concerns had been carefully assembled in the form of a petition from the prospectors and delivered to the administration, who absolutely laughed them out of the room. Religion was also a powerful force in the Australian goldfields, and that was one of the reasons that it was seen by all as a cowardly manoeuvre when at dawn on a Sunday morning, 300 well-prepared troops and police, both mounted and on foot, attacked the Eureka Stockade in the dark on a Sunday morning when many of the diggers were away with their families. Only about 150 diggers were there in the stockade, many of them unprepared and asleep. Many of them asleep with their wives and their children when the troops attacked. The ratio of those killed, butchered actually, 30 miners as opposed to 5 soldiers represents the imbalance of the battle. Public sympathy in Victoria was such that the 13 arrested and charged with high treason were all found to be not guilty. 2 of them, in fact, then continued on to be members of the Victorian Parliament and continue their good work in bringing in democratic reforms in the form of voting for it was just a very, very private club of people who had a vote until these guys exerted their muscles. So they brought a democracy in a way to the colony. So they might have lost the battle on that Sunday morning, but they won the real fight. The background, a little bit more background, was the influx of more than 100,000 miners, and this is to explain why there was a tendency toward violence in those days. The influx of more than 100,000 miners to the Victorian goldfields was an interesting mixture. Half were Irishmen, And they'd been brought up in on the epic and heroic tale of the 1798 rebellion at County Wexford near Dublin, where 20,000 people were killed out of a population of 120,000. There were many Americans there also, mainly from the Californian Gold Rush, with a tradition of the War of Independence. The rest of them were from Europe, some with first-hand or family involvement in the then-current Crimean and Sebastopol conflict, where 600,000 people died, and in early memories of the French Revolution, where 25,000 died. A small digression. One of my early mentors explained to me in 1978 that there really are four methods of exerting change. If you want to exert change, there's four ways of doing it. One is peaceful civil disobedience. The second one is education. The third one is through political influence. And the fourth one is through war slash violence. I've elected for education. I like education because you can actually measure the long-term results of it. Anyway, back to the story. The people in Ballarat, that explains the tradition of violence they had, because that was their background. They didn't have the benefit of excellent communications, the internet, and the democratic votes, and their wonderful NBN. They're almost no Australians at the Ballarat Revolt. We had all come from somewhere else. Now, 164 years later, the world's learning to appreciate us as a people, small in number, who've melded ourselves into this wonderful race called Australians. One of our features is that we all, small in number, but we always manage to punch above our weight. And I think it's constructive. We don't get enough of it, but it's instructive to be positive about what makes Australians different. Outside of the US, Australia's about the only country where people can come to Australia and be Australians. You can't go to Greece and become Greek. You can't go to Japan and become Japanese. You can't go to Switzerland and become Swiss. Not on. But sure, you can come to Australia and become Australian. A real plus. And I think that's the qualities that we've blended by combining the treasures. We forget this, the importance of the British common law and property rights. We've merged that, a beautiful blend, with the creativity and energy and the initiative of such a wide mix of people together. So, and I think the Eureka, the rebellion memory and tradition has been very much of giving us this competitive edge. The incredible thing is that despite the Eureka Rebellion being almost completely ignored by our education system, despite the union movement hijacking the Eureka flag and its memory by presenting it as a symbol of mob rule, despite a contemporary musical called Eureka defining the Eureka Rebellion as a politically correct revisionist absurdity, despite all that, the overwhelming majority of Australians who have familiarised themselves with that story have understood the importance and the lasting significance of the Eureka Rebellion for the enduring nature of democracy in Australia, a country which is one of the oldest continuous democracies in the world. The key to understanding and preserving democracy is to ensure that it does not generate into the tyranny of the majority, where we allow pressure groups to impose their priorities on the rest of us. I think the philosopher-writer Ayn Rand put it well when she said, "Individual rights are not subject to public vote. A majority has no right to vote away the rights of a minority. The political function of rights is precisely to protect minorities from oppression by majorities, and the smallest minority on earth is the individual." That's what she said. And let me add that she was talking about people like us, just going about our business, in our case, building a better Australia. There can be nothing more creative than that. never underestimate the importance of what we all do in creating a better country. The private sector, the people that are actually doing stuff, is the powerhouse of Australia. Now, we know, we make no excuses, we know we have to fight our own battles. We know that our responsibilities rest on our shoulders. And as Thomas Paine once said, those who expect to reap the benefits of freedom must undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, another famous patriot, Thomas Jefferson, once said, "I hold that a little rebellion now and then is a good thing and as necessary in the political world as storms in the physical." And that's where I pinched the title for this talk today. So in conclusion, let me say, there are not many trigger points, as we say, in business that acted as a catalyst for making Australians different. Let me suggest that the 1854 Eureka Rebellion is one of those occasions, and the other is the 1915 Anzac Gallipoli experience. So let's take up that worthy baton in life's relay race and get on with the job of defending our rights and freedom to conduct our lives and our business with minimum interference. We have the modern communication tools to continue that Eureka revolt without spilling any blood. We just got to work smarter at it, just as the enemies of industry are working smart at closing down industries and putting hurdles in the place of anybody that wants to start something up in Australia. Gets all this stuff that they've got to jump across and it can take years. We have technology, economics and morality on our side, so all we need is the physical courage and moral courage to win. Our livelihood depends on us winning these battles, and it goes beyond this. If Australia is to achieve its potential, it depends more than ever on people such as ourselves relentlessly becoming involved in keeping this Eureka dream alive. Now, I celebrated my part in that 2004 150th event with this poem called "The Next Eureka Moment." "Put some words into the Eureka time capsule," they said. "Me, who already has a head full of stuff every time I go to bed." "If you're still around 2054, they said, "you'll be on the invite list." It's in my diary. Well, that was an invitation I simply could not resist. And so it got me thinking about splitting 200 years into four. Discovery dividends. Before the banking crash in Victoria, Australia finding its feet again, brave moves were made, with some quite rash. Then came the second quarter, which is 1904 to 54, when the very bad overwhelmed the best. Two world wars and a depression made it not just rough, but very tough, particularly for those who headed west. Then, 1954 till now, third quarter. Bad start, but hope toward the end. Restrictive policies discouraged. Some cautious experiments were made, and enterprise, to our surprise, was encouraged. So the next quarter is the one for us to make a stance. And we'll be in there fighting. Yes, we still have a chance. Government's lofty plans for us conflict with our plan. So can we shape our future now? With time and thought and confidence, I reckon we can. So when they dig up that capsule in 2054, I'll come from the west, join Eureka's best, and ready to write some more. So that's the end of my Eureka comment. I was going to go on with about an hour of my concerns about all the things that really worried me, but I won't. What I'll do is I'll take questions, but after concluding with my annual festive poem. If I may, a short one. And it's been a funny year. You referred to that earlier. It's been a really weird year. So I've called the year, and the poem is called "The Gift of 2020. Who would have imagined the surprise of coronavirus could be a golden gift of the rarest kind? There we were, going about our affairs in the conventional way, quietly completing our tasks. We travelled here, we travelled there, sitting at airports pretending to achieve. Then normality was stolen, plucked from our plate, robbing us of the ability to rush, not to be late. Now, as the year closes, we can pause and ponder. Coronavirus gave us the gift of many precious hours. How did we invest or waste the gift of those hours? Did we write that promised book? Did we work on those many lists? Or even take a serious look? What did we learn? How have we changed? Did we fail as we watch the year's setting sun? The situation handled so differently, observed from near and far, some not so fortunate, with much still to learn. Will we be happy looking back at how we invested those lonely hours, or sadly realised that we had only pissed them up against the wall? Thank you, good folks.